Hi, everyone.
Use the mic. Otherwise, they can't hear. Use the mic.
What's up, guys? How are you? How was your spring break? Sorry, before Professor de Moterin speaks, I'd just like to make an announcement. I'm a student trainer with Adventist Financial Certification Modeling Program, which is coming to NYU on April 2nd and 3rd, and basically they teach you how to beef up your Excel skills, especially if you're interested in a career in investment banking or in private equity. You could practice before your internship this semester, or if you're a sophomore looking for an internship. I took this in my sophomore spring semester, and it really helped me get my internship this summer. So if you're interested in a career in finance and you really want to just have this experience or this help with your Excel skills, please come up to me and you can sign up after class on this sheet. I'll just leave it in the front just for everybody to sign up. It's about $295. Honestly, it is quite cheap compared to its competitors, Wall Street Prep, which is about $2,000 to $3,000. So I think it's a great experience and a real help to furthering your career and skills in finance and Excel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So who's jet lagged? You'll get over it.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world. You're not going to die. You just feel like you're going to die, but you're going to be okay. Right? Just get out of the sunlight, get a lot of exercise. You'll be okay. Anyway, I want to remind you again that your case should be ongoing. So if you haven't, excuse me, if you haven't even read,
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
If you haven't even read it yet, then you're behind. So it's due next Wednesday, before 10:30. I want to emphasize that, not before 3:30, but before 10:30 on Wednesday. So that's 9 days from today. So if you haven't started yet, get started now. Okay. I won't talk much about the case specifically, but almost everything I said in the last session has relevance to the case. Almost everything I'm going to say in this session has relevance to the case. Almost everything I will say in the next session, which means if you've read the case, which is what I suggested you do last night in that email, then you'll be able to find things as we go along saying, hey, maybe that'll be useful. If you haven't read it, of course, it's up to you. Okay? So last part of Wednesday, we were talking about time-weighted incremental cash flow returns. Remember that process we went through with the Disney, Rio Disney? We started with accounting earnings, and the project did not look good. 4.18% return on capital, cost of capital is 8.5%. We said, don't take the project, but then he said, wait, we stopped after 10 years, so we might need to do something. Then we moved from earnings to cash flows by adding back depreciation, subtracting out CapEx, subtracting change in working capital. And then we went from cash flows to incremental cash flows. That is a critical step because what we're saying is not everything that is expense deserves to be expense. Not everything that's shown as income deserves to be shown as income. It's what changes because of this project that you should focus on. In fact, that's the only advice I will give you on the case, is do not get distracted. There's a big company out there, right? The Netflix, which is doing all of this stuff. It's easy to get into their financials and start looking at all kinds of stuff. Focus on what changes, not what does not change. Sounds very Buddhist, but take it for what it's worth. You will know what I'm talking about as you read the case. Because lots of stuff that'll be happening, but if none of it has anything to do with the case, why are you even interested in it, okay? So focus on incremental cash flows. And then the very last part of the class, we said we need to time weight them. What's time weighting? That's what discounting is, effectively, right? Time weighting cash flows. And there are two measures of time weighted incremental cash flow returns. The first is the net present value. Net present value, here's what you do. You take each cash flow, you discount it back to today using your discount rate. You add up the present values, not the cash flows themselves, but the present value of the cash flows all together. And what you get as a sum is called the net present value. And the decision rule is very simple. If that net present value is positive, even if it's only $1, you should take the investment. And that always puzzles people. How can you have an investment with a $10 billion initial investment and accept a net present value of a dollar? So let me throw that question back on you. Why is even a single dollar in net present value okay if you're looking at a $10 billion investment? Doesn't sound like a very low return, dollar on $10 billion? Yes. Because this is over and above your cost of capital. Remember that. So you've earned your cost of capital. So when I say your net present value is a dollar, I'm not saying you're making a dollar. You're making your cost of capital plus a dollar. And the reason I want you to take it rather than doing nothing, it's what's the net present value of doing nothing? Don't think too long. It's zero. I think one is still greater than zero. Would you rather take 100 over 1? Sure. Would you rather take 100 million over 100? Yes. So you're saying, why can't I wait for a project which will deliver a net present value of 100 million? Because beggars can't be choosers. If you're a company with an insane amount of projects coming at you, you can stop and say, I'll take only projects with net present values greater than 100 million. But you might not have that choice. If this is all you can do, take this project. So that's the first approach. Take the present values, add them all up, come up with the net present value. Here's the other. There is some discount rate at which your net present value will be zero. So basically, you can try different discount rates. There's some discount rate at which your NPV will become zero. That's called your internal rate of return. Think of that as the time-weighted incremental cash flow analog to the accounting return on capital. You'll still get a percentage number, but this will now be based on cash flows rather than earnings, and will be time-weighted. And once you get that internal rate of return, you're going to compare that to whatever your hurdle rate is to decide whether you will invest in this project or not. So we're going to bring both those approaches into play on Rio Disney. And remember, your job still remains to make the decision. So kind of sit back and say, you know, let's look at the numbers come through and let's see if this project passes muster. Before I actually show you the NPV and the IRR for this project, there's one loose end I want to tie up, and it goes back to what we were doing before the break when I did the return on capital. Remember, after I stopped after 10 years, I waved my hands and said I should have gone on longer. This project will probably last a lot longer than 10 years because theme parks last for 30, 40, 50 years. With accounting returns on capital, there's very little I could do with that insight. But when I do cash flows, there's a way I can stop in year 10 and still deal with what happens after year 10. And that's by using one of the equations I showed you towards the very end of the last class, which is a growing perpetuity. What is a growing perpetuity? Cash flow that grows at a constant rate forever. You're saying, how is that going to help me? Does Disney raise ticket prices every year? Are you familiar with the... I've watched Disney ticket prices go up. Every single year, inflation goes through into the ticket prices. So let me make an assumption. Let's assume that after year 10, this project doesn't end. It keeps going and going and going. For how long? Forever. I know forever is a really long time, but I kind of hang in there anyway. The number of tourists coming into the theme park levels off in year 10. You're saying, why do you let the number of tourists also keep going and growing and growing? If I do, I'll have a problem, right? Which is? My theme parks are going to get really, really crowded. In which case, I have to build a bigger theme park. I don't want to do that. I want to bring in a fresh... I don't want to expand the theme park. I want to keep the theme park at the same size, but I want to assume that your cash flows will grow. So after year 10, I'm going to assume that the cash flows grow at the inflation rate, which I assume to be 2% forever. It's a growing perpetuity, right? The present value of a growing perpetuity is I take the cash flow 1 year after. This is always the case with present value equations. So my cash flow in year 11, which is my cash flow in year 10 grown out at 2%, divided by the difference between my cost of capital that I estimated for this theme park of 8.5%, that includes the Brazil country risk, minus the 2%, which gives me $11,275 million. That's called a terminal value. As opposed to what? As opposed to what's called a salvage value. Salvage value is when you shut a project down, sell the pieces off, and get whatever you can. I'm not assuming salvage. I'm assuming the project will keep going. And I get a terminal value of $11,275 million. Let me tell you, I actually did this at Disney a few years ago, probably 8-9 years ago. And there's a manager in the audience who put up his hand and said, I know theme parks last a long time, but they don't last forever. And he's right, right? Seems like an extreme assumption. So I said, how long do you think theme parks last? He said, 50 to 60 years. I said, okay. What if I computed the present value of a growing annuity for 50 to 60 years, 2% growth every year? He said, that'll be much better. And I said, you know what my answer is going to be if I do that? It's going to be $11.15 billion. When we use perpetuity equations, and we use them all the time in finance, it's not because we're being completely unrealistic about the fact that the world might come to an end. It's just we're saying if you have a long enough time period, if you get past 40 or 50 years, you might as well use the perpetuity formula because it's more convenient. It's a pure convenience assumption. That's the $11,275 million. I'm ready. So here's what I have. I have my incremental cash flows for the next 10 years that I estimated for the theme park. At the end of year 10, I have $11,275 million as my terminal value. So let me pause right there. If you end up in finance, you're going to use this terminal value number over and over again. I want you to think about intuitively what exactly that number means. So when I say the 11,275 in year 10, how would you describe it to somebody who's not in finance? What exactly does that 11,275 million tell me? Anybody? Yes, Roy. Is it a cash flow, though? Because it's like a composite amount, right? So it's coming from the cash flows, but it's really more than just the cash flow, right?
In year 10, all the cash flows coming afterward today are worth $11,000.
See, I'll tell you something. When you say cash flows and throw numbers out at non-finance people, and let's assume I'm going to have no idea what you're talking about, right? You're right. Both of you are right. It's coming from the cash flows. It is the present value of the cash flows. Here's the best way to think about terminal value. If I sold this theme park, lock, stock, barrel, and Mickey included. You see why Mickey's got to be included? If I try to sell the theme park, I'm going to pull my characters out. Nobody's going to pay me $11,275 million. If I'm willing to sell the entire theme park to somebody, this is what they should be willing to pay me. That's the terminal value. So that's what I'm putting in year 10. By far the biggest number in these cash flows. Justin?
Selling at the end of year 10.
At the end of year 10. So that's actually an interesting point. When you see years in a cash flow statement, we act like everything happens at the end of each year, which is not really true, right? It happens during the course of the year. It's a convenience assumption we make. At the end of year 10, we sell this entire theme park for $11,275 million. And that captures the cash flows beyond year 10. Do you think Disney would ever sell a theme park, Mickey included? There is no way. So this is a hypothetical. They will never do it, but if they chose to do it, this is what they would get. I'm ready. I discount these cash flows back at the cost of capital. When I took corporate finance, the sequencing always puzzled me because we did capital budgeting first in the first 3 or 4 weeks of class where we talk about cash flows, and then the instructor would throw a discount rate. So we'll talk about discount rates later. So we'll talk about cash flows. We'll do a net present value, making up discount rates as we went along. And around the fifth week, we started on discount rates and said, now we can talk about discount rates, but it was really too late. Now do you see why I sequenced things the way I did? The reason I spent so much time on the cost of equity and capital is you needed to do investment analysis. I discount these cash flows back at the 8.5% cost of capital, including the big number at the end of year 10. What I get as the sum of all of my cash flows, present values, is $3.3 billion. That is the net present value of this investment. So complete it. You're the decision maker. I show you this net present value table. Should I accept this investment or not? What's the threshold I have to beat? Zero. I think $3.3 billion beats zero by a healthy margin. You take it. Okay? I'll go further. If you take this investment as a company, Disney's value will increase by $3.3 billion. One of the neat things about net present value is every time you take a positive net present value investment, your value as a company increases by that amount. So if I had gone out and taken a project with a net present value of $1 billion, my net present value as a company would have gone up by $1 billion. If I took a project with a net present value of zero, nothing happens to my value. If I take a project with a net present value of minus $3 billion, bad things will happen to my stock price. You're saying, who'd be stupid enough to do it? Every year, there are at least 40 to 50 transactions where companies go out and take projects with net present values of minus $2 billion, minus $3 billion, minus $5 billion. What am I talking about? What kind of projects have that kind of negative net present value? can't be in internal projects. It takes so much money to get to that amount. I've kind of given away a clue. It has to be? What? Let's not put names on it. You know, we have no idea whether driverless cars are good or bad. It's got to be some kind of a acquisition, exactly. You make a $30 billion acquisition, you overpay by $7 billion. Guess what? That's like taking a project with a net present value of minus $7 billion. 55% of all M&A transactions, the acquiring company's stock price drops in the announcement of the transaction. And in a significant number, the acquiring company's stock price loses more than $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion on the announcement of the transaction. Whatever the story you might be telling stockholders, they're not buying it. They're reducing the value of the equity, saying this investment is a negative net present value investment. So any questions on NPV? So just adding up the present values of the cash flows using the cost of capital for the project that we have to estimate using the fact that it's based on its risk, based on what country it's located in. Now, to compute the IRR, I could have hit the IRR button in my Excel, but I've never trusted that. I don't even know what it comes out with. So I'm going to actually try to compute IRR on my own using a very simple process. Remember what I said, the IRR is that discount rate that makes the net present value zero? So I kept the cash flows in that table, and I kept changing discount rates from 8 to 9 to 10 to 11 and plotting the net present values as my discount rate changed. So no surprise here. As my discount rate goes up, my net present value decreases, which is normally the case. It's not always the case, but normally the case. What's my IRR? It's that point at which my discount rate, at which my net present value is zero. In this particular example, in the Disney theme park, that number works out to be 12.60%. What do I compare that to? That's my internal rate of return. I compare that to my 8.46% cost of capital. And that basically tells me that this project is a good project. Now, the net present value told you it was a good project. The IRR, will that always be the case? When the net present value says take the project, will the IRR also say take the project? Most of the time. We're going to come back and talk about some exceptions where that might not be the case. But most of the time, the two decisions will drive you towards the same choice. Okay. One other interesting feature of this graph. Notice the slope of the line. You remember enough geometry or calculus to tell me what this is. What does the slope of the line tell me? How sensitive my net present value is to changes in my discount rate, right? You're saying, who cares? Let's say you have two projects you have to pick between. They have the same net present value. But one is less sensitive. In other words, it's much more slightly sloped, right, relative to the other. That's a measure of risk, right? You'd rather take the project which is less sensitive to discount rate changes than one that is more. So this net present value profile is not just to get an internal rate of return, but to get a sense of, hey, how much can I be wrong in the discount rate and still be okay? So that's the IRR, both time-weighted incremental cash flow measures. So most of the time, as I said, the IRR and the NPV give you the same answer. There will be cases where they're different, and I'll come back and talk about them, but let me set the table here. First is, a project can have only one net present value. You can never have more than one. So one discount rate, one set of cash flows. You can have more than one IRR, and we'll come back and talk about when that happens. Second, the NPV is a dollar value, $3.3 billion, $5.5 billion, minus $3 billion. The IRR is a percentage number. You're saying, who cares? Managers are actually much more comfortable with percentage numbers than dollar values, which might explain why more people use IRR than NPV. And we'll come back and talk about what the NPV assumes about cash flows you get in year one, two, and three. It assumes you can reinvest those cash flows at your hurdle rate, the cost of capital, the cost of equity. The IRR makes a more dangerous assumption you can reinvest at the IRR. So all issues we'll come back and wrestle with. But I want to kind of tie up some loose ends on this project. When I started presenting numbers on this project, I said I was going to cheat and give you all the cash flows in US dollars, right? And I said it was cheating because everything will be in nominal reais. Then I used the cost of capital in US dollars to come up with the net present value of $3.3 billion. Now let's say that now that we've kind of established the project looks good on a dollar basis, I'm much more interested in going back and doing it right. Do you think my answer would have been different if I'd done everything in nominal riyas. Think about it, because if you say yes, you've dug a very deep hole for yourself. Do you see why? Because then if I ask you if your project is a good project, and you do it in one currency and you get one answer, you switch currencies, you get a different answer, what are you going to tell me? Take the project, don't take the project. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can either have a good project or not. So if you really want to stay comfortable with analyses, you don't want your numbers to change or your decision to change just because you switch currencies. So I'm going to try. Let's see what happens if I go from US dollars to nominal riyals. Let's start with the easy half of the equation. My US dollar cost of capital is what? 8.46%, right? If I did everything in nominal riyals, will I have a higher cost of capital or a lower cost of capital? You got a 50-50 shot. Go for it. Higher. Why? No. Risk can't be the answer, because risk is already built into your... When you do your dollar cost of capital, you can't ignore the fact it's a risky business in a risky country. We brought both into the cost of capital. So switching currencies can't change the risk. It's because its difference is in inflation. And remember we did this when we did cost of equity and cost of debt? If I do everything in nominal riyals, I have to have a nominal riyal discount rate and nominal riyal cash flows, and the inflation in the riyal will then show up in both places. Let's see how. My US dollar cost of capital is 8.46%, right? The inflation rate I'm going to assume in nominal riyals is 9%. The inflation rate in US dollars is 2%. This is exactly the same calculation I did before with cost of equity and cost of debt. My nominal riyal cost of capital for this project is 15.91%. And again, the difference is not because riyals are risky and dollars are safe. The two are equivalently risky, but one is a higher inflation currency and the other is a lower inflation currency. This is bad, right? Higher discount rate. What else do I now need to do? If I decide to do my discount rate in riyals, adjust your cash flows. I have to make my cash flows into nominal riyal cash flows. Any ideas on how I should do that? I have my cash flows in dollars. Right now what's built into those cash flows is an inflation rate. A 2% inflation rate, right? And I know the inflation rate in riyals is 9%. Here's the easiest way to bring in differences of inflation into your cash flows. How do I convert dollar cash flows into riyal cash flows? What do I need? I need an exchange rate, right? I know what the exchange rate is right now. At the time that I did this, it was 2.35 riyals per dollar. Here's what I did to get the expected exchange rate in future periods. I took that same 9% and 2% inflation rate that I used to adjust my discount rate, and I estimated what the exchange rate would have to be in future years. So what's happening is the riyal is depreciating roughly 7% a year. This is called purchasing power parity. It's one of the building blocks for thinking about exchange rates. So I projected the numbers out. So what's happening over the 10 years is you're almost halving the value of the riyal because of the higher inflation rate. I actually was in Brazil in 2009, and I put this table up, and some guy in the audience started laughing. He said, "You can't really be telling me that the riyal will lose half its value over the next 10 years. And the reason he felt so secure is in the previous 10 years, the riyal had strengthened from about 3.5 riyals per share to 2. So he was convinced that this was an endless game where the riyal would get strengthening and strengthening. And when I mentioned purchasing power parity, he said, "That's an old-fashioned thing. It doesn't apply anymore." Guess what the Brazilian riyal is at right now? It's about 4.5 riyals. They actually got there faster than I thought they would, because I was projecting it in the year 2000 and something, 23. They're getting there much faster. So now I have a different problem, which is they're depleting or depreciating faster than I thought they were. But that's my expected exchange rate. So I convert my dollar cash flows into riyal cash flows. I discount the riyal cash flows at the riyal cost of capital. I get a net present value of 7,745 million riyals. Last step, I divide by today's exchange rate, 2.35 riyals per share. And guess what I get as my net present value? 3,296 million, exactly to the nth decimal point, the same net present value I got if I did everything in US dollars. There's nothing else you take out of this class. Think about this principle of currency invariance. People are incredibly sloppy with the way they work with currencies, which is one reason why when they value a company in one currency and switch it to a different currency, they can get two wildly different answers. You shouldn't. If you're doing that, there's something you're bringing into the valuation that's a currency view, and you should not be bringing that view into a capital budgeting analysis. So if I did everything in nominal reais, I still get the same conclusion. This is a good project. Now, it looked like a bad project when I did it in accounting returns, right? So what do you think flipped the decision from bad to good? What did I add in my cash flow analysis that made it go from being bad to good? Depreciation was only a small piece, right? I added depreciation, but I subtracted capex. So what one hand gave you, the other hand took away, right?
Our ability to sell it.
The terminal value number. It's what I did after year 10 that made the difference, right? Because in the accounting returns, I stopped after year 10. Justin? Doesn't matter, right? When I did cost of capital, what did I do? I took a risk-free rate in dollars. I took a big, The risk-free, I did it in dollars only because I wanted to do it in dollars. It's not because it's a U.S. company. I just chose to do everything in U.S. dollars. Chase, you're given the U.S. dollar. What other currency do you want to do it in? Rupees? You could if you want to. And as I said, if you do it right, it doesn't matter. If you really want to torture yourself by doing this in rupees or rupiah or pesos or Singapore dollars, be my guest. Why would you go looking for trouble? All the inputs are given in US dollars. You then have to convert it into rupees. Of course, if you did it right, it should come to the same answer. But why? Because your initial investment? Do not connect what country you're using the equity risk premium to what currency you have to use. They're completely independent choices, right? Separate the two. So don't get locked into currencies because of something else you've done. Make your currency choice your own and then stick with it. Okay? So any questions? So now let me ask you a question. All these numbers that I gave you, for Disney, and all the numbers you're going to give me for the Netflix case, even though they're reflecting what I gave you in the case, are assumptions, right? Assumptions about how many people will come to the theme park, assumptions about direct expenses, assumptions about capital expenditures, assumptions, lots of assumptions, tax rates, equity risk premiums. In fact, every single number in that capital budgeting exercise we just did was an estimate. A lot of uncertainty. I could be wrong, right? Could be wrong on tax rates. I could be wrong on inflation. I could be wrong on how many people come in. I could be wrong. Absolutely. And this is going to be true in almost everything you guys will be doing for the rest of your lives. You do even your best case. You know, you put in all the work you want at the end of the process. You're going to look at your number and say, I could be wrong. In fact, if you don't have that feeling, there's something seriously wrong with you. You have some... Mentally, you've gone off the tracks. Of course you're going to be wrong. So now I'm going to ask you what to do next. And I'll give you the choices. You could sit there and wait for the uncertainty to resolve itself. In which case, how long are you going to be waiting? Forever. You're in business. This isn't going away. You're saying, let me just wait for the China crisis to be over. So maybe it will be in 2017. Guess what? There'll be something else. So that's not an option. Maybe you're one of those people who says, I will not take an investment if there's any risk. Well, good luck to you. You have a nice company with a lot of cash sitting around, nothing else to do with it. Okay? Maybe you can ask someone else, a consultant, an expert. You know how many companies take this option? You know why? Because then if something goes wrong, what do they say? It's not my fault. He told me to do it. McKinsey told me this was a good project. Really? McKinsey told you it was a good project, so you had to go take it. Horrible option, but people take it all the time. Maybe you're one of those strange people who's got that piece of your brain missing where uncertainty doesn't bother you. Do you know that very successful traders and psychopaths? No, seriously. They've taken pictures of brains, share a common brain structure. It's a capacity that emotional component that makes us do stupid things under risk, both people lack. So maybe it's healthier to become a traitor than a psychopath, but maybe you have psychopathic tendencies. You notice this, and everybody else has a lot of uncertainty. Oh, I don't care. The rest of you, I'd step away. This person is very close to either going one way or the other. You don't want to be in the wrong place if he decides to go the serial killer route. Right? Like you could be the next Dexter for all you know. Right? Or maybe there's something else you can do. I cannot ignore uncertainty. So when I sat down and valued Valiant in October, or I valued Apple last month, I couldn't just say, no, of course I feel uncertain. If I'm going to act on this, I have to deal with the uncertainty. So I'm going to suggest some ways in which people have tried to deal with, because this is age-long. As long as people have been making business decisions, this is something that they've always faced. So here's the first thing you can do. What's the big thing that worries you on this theme park? It's a big investment, right? You're investing almost $5 billion and you're worried that you might lose it. So wouldn't it be nice if you could at least get the $5 billion back? I know it doesn't make you whole, but at least you can say, look, I got my investment back. Now I can worry about making more cash flows. A lot of investment analyses, you have what's called a payback period. Payback period tells you how many years it takes you to make your initial investment back. It's a very old-fashioned measure, but you can see why people like it. If I can get my cash flows, my initial investment back, then I can worry about the good stuff later. In the case of this particular theme park, it takes almost 10 years to get your initial investment back. You say, how would I use it? Many companies that have a payback threshold restrict you from taking any project that doesn't pay back within that period. In real estate, for instance, there are very conservative companies that say, we don't get our payback in 7 years, we're not taking a project. So that becomes a constraint. There's a cost to constraints, but you can see why people do it. In fact, you can even do a discounted payback, which means you want to make sure you get your net present value, present value of your cash flows back. So that's the first and most simplistic way of dealing with uncertainty, just try to get your cash flows back. Here's the second. What if analyses? What if this? What if that? No, what if something else? I'll be quite honest. I think it's become far too easy to ask what if questions. That sounds like an incredibly crazy thing to say. I'll take you back. It was the summer of 1980. I was in the middle of my MBA program. Summer of 1980. The economy was in a deep recession. No jobs to be found. So my summer job that year was with a company called Watermark. This is a company that had one product. It had a radio show that it produced that it syndicated. You know what syndicating a radio show is? You sell it to radio stations. The radio stations pay you $1,000 a week for running the show. It's one show. In fact, it was a radio show that some of you might have heard of, and it still plays, called American Top 40. If any of you have driven around the country on a Sunday, this is an incredibly creative concept. Here's how it goes. They start with song number 40. And they count down to song number one. It's the genius who thought of that. And between the songs, they have, this chat. And I think, does anybody know who's the master? It used to be a guy called Casey Kasem, but now it's, I think, the guy from American Idol? Ryan Seacrest, that's right. Yeah. So when I was called in 1980, that was the only show this company had. It was run by a guy called Casey Kasem, and they wanted me to look at a new show they were thinking of called Soundtrack of the 60s. Remember, this is 1980, right? Here's what they were going to do. They were going to go back 20 years in time and take the same week in 1960, and guess what they were going to do? Play down the top 40 songs from that week. Incredibly novel spin-off of that concept. So they hired me and they said, we'd like you to look at this show called Soundtrack of the 60s and tell us whether we should invest in the show, start the show. So I walk in, I'd taken one corporate finance class, and I walk in small offices, everybody has cubicles, including the CFO and the CEO. And I walk into the CFO's cubicle, and I said, I'd like to see the cash flows, because every problem I'd ever done in class had come with cash flows. He handed me a ledger book. Have you ever seen a ledger book? These old books that had big columns drawn. So the big advantage was the columns were already drawn, so you didn't have to draw them. It was blank. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this? He said, you're supposed to fill this with your line items for the show. That's when I realized that in the real world, projects don't come with cash flows. You're supposed to estimate them. So I sit there looking at this blank sheet for the first day, saying, what the hell do I do? I don't know anything about this business. I don't know what it costs to produce a radio show, how many stations will buy it. So I decided I had to do some research. So I went to the marketing guy's cubicle, and he hated me from the minute he saw me. I was a numbers guy, and he was a creative guy. And you know how creative and numbers guys get and don't get along. So for 3 days, he acted like I wasn't there, which is tough to do when you have a cubicle and somebody's standing right outside for 3 days. So after about 3 days, I said, you know what? I have to get started. So I said, I know you don't like me, but I need to get started. How many stations do you think you can sell this new show to? He said, I don't know, 100, 200, 300, something like that. I said, okay, this is the best I'm going to get from this guy. I went back to my mini cubicle, and I got started. My base case, guess how many stations I gave Soundtrack of the 60s? He said, 100, 200, 300. I said, I'll go with 200. It's right in the middle. As good as any other, right? I could have made it 207 to make it look like I'd done some serious research. And I should have done it. But that's a trick I learned later. When in doubt, add decimals, you know. And make it look like a not a round number. So I started 200. And this is how I built my entire ledger sheet. Line item by line item was like pulling teeth. And 6 weeks later, I had the whole sheet filled out by hand with an abacus, but a calculator. I wasn't that old. Okay. So I finished the sheet. I come up with the net present value. Moment of glory. I go to the CEO and say, I'm ready to present my findings. He's making balloons and celebrations. He said, come around at about 2 o'clock. There's three guys sitting around a coffee table and me. And it was the CEO, the CFO, and one of the directors of the company. It was that smaller company. The director just walked in and sat at the coffee table. I sit across. I go through line item by line item. And the climactic moment comes. The net present value of this project is minus $31 million. You should not do it. They look at each other and say, what would happen if you tried 300 stations? My stomach drops. This isn't an Excel spreadsheet. I'll have to go through every single number on the ledger, every single one with 300. I said, why? They said, we'd already decided to do the show. We just wanted to confirm it for us. I said, you hired me to confirm a decision you'd already made? Yeah, they said, yes. We need confirmation so we can file this away. I thought at that moment it was because they were a small company, not very sophisticated. I'll tell you what I've discovered the following 35 years. This is more the rule than the exception. In most companies, decisions get made first, then number crunching follows. What's the idea to back a decision that's already been made? It's kabuki capital budgeting. You seen kabuki dances? Very elaborate, right? But everything is planned. This is kabuki capital budgeting. Okay. But in those days, if you ask what-if questions, it took you forever to answer them, so that meant you did not ask too many what-if questions. Today, though, you have Excel spreadsheets. You're one of those Excel ninjas and take one of those classes that was listed at the start. You could be hitting macros on top of macros, doing wonderful stuff with this. And it's become too easy to ask what-if questions. I've been doing this case now for a long time. Every year I make up a different case. And every time I beg of the class the same thing, and I'm going to beg it of you now. Whatever you do, don't make this an exercise in writing pages and pages and pages and pages. Keep it short and keep, because you have a singular mission. In fact, my suggestion is if it's going past 4 pages, you're writing way too much. You can have exhibits and tables and stuff, obviously, beyond pages. But if your writing exceeds 4 pages, something is definitely wrong. The strategy part of you is going crazy. Suppress it. And most semesters, people listen. I think about 2 or 3 years ago, I'd given the Apple iCar as my case. And I'd gone, so it's very similar to what you see for Netflix content. I ask people to. So I get back all these project reports. Most people have listened. It's 8 to 10 pages. And then there is this report, which is 110 pages. Because what did these guys do? Bound, elaborate color. They did it in Kinko's. No. I open it up and they've run 105 different scenarios. Scenarios like, what if Janet Yellen catches a cold? This is what the Apple iCar will do. I'm convinced they probably ran a macro. But here's the problem they ran into. In 55 of the scenarios, they got positive net present values. In 50, they got negative net present values. And remember what your end mission is. You've got to tell me whether you're going to take the investment or not. Here's how they ended. They said, if you know you're going to be in a positive scenario, take the project. If you believe you're going to be in a negative scenario, don't take the project. Thank you very much. That is very helpful that you've told me this. But they also made the confession that they were so confused, they didn't know what to do. And you know what? That's where lots of people end up after they've done the what-if analysis. What-if analysis is supposed to lead you to converge on a decision, not diverge. So if you're going to do what-if analysis, here are my suggestions. First, keep it limited. Keep it focused. Make one or two variables your what-if variables. Don't change everything on the face of the earth. In fact, my suggestion is don't change anything you can't control. Like interest rates. It's none of your business. You can't control it. Let it go. And when you've got the numbers, don't turn out table after table. In fact, I'll make a statement up front so you don't blame me afterwards. If you give me a case with 15 tables, I guarantee you I'm not looking at 14 of the 15 tables unless you very specifically draw my attention to something on those tables. I'm going to look at your basic cash flow table, but don't turn our table after table of, you know, exhibit scenario one, scenario two. I don't care. So you got to find a way to take your what-if findings and put it in a format that helps me make my decision. And I think I have to blame Excel for what's happened in the last 20 years. This insert chart is such an easy command. It's right there. You want to insert a chart for everything. You have revenues last year, revenues this year. Insert chart. I don't need a chart. Two numbers. You can just tell me what the two numbers are. Two big bars next to each other tell me nothing that I did not know before you showed me the two big bars. You can make them 3D. Maybe even four-dimensional. It doesn't change it. 100 million last year, 120 million. You can just tell me 100 to 120 million. I kind of get it. So here's my suggestion, and this is something that is less to do with the class and more going forward. In business, one of the biggest challenges we face is we have too much data coming at us. So if you're a data cruncher, a number cruncher, your job is not just to crunch those numbers, but to then present it in a way that people are not numbers people kind of get what you're trying to deliver. Visualizing data, presenting it in a creative way, is an art form in itself. And if you're good at it, that is an incredibly. In fact, if I were doing a class for people to be ready, it won't be a class on Excel and turning out more spreadsheets. It's how to take the stuff in spreadsheets and present it in a way that everybody kind of gets what's in the spreadsheets. So I'm going to give you a reading reference. I know you're not going to be reading this book right now, but set it aside sometime during the, you know, during the summer, I'd like you to read the book. It's by a guy called Tufte, Edward Tufte, T-U-F-T-E. He's one of the world's leading experts on the visual display of information. In fact, the book he wrote was called The Visual Display of Information. It's about how to present data creatively. And in that graph is my favorite picture of all time. Okay. It's actually a hand-drawn picture, which is almost 150 years old, that explains what happened to Napoleon when he tried to invade Russia in the 1800s. So let me give you a very short history lesson. The early 1800s, Napoleon, of course, Emperor of France, decides he wants to invade Russia. What this fixation with invading Russia is with Europeans, is, I don't know. Maybe it's big, it's out there, they want to invade it. So Napoleon wakes up one day and says, I want to invade Russia. He's emperor, whatever he decides. So he gathers this huge army, and he marches out of Paris. That's Napoleon leaving Paris. The breadth of this graph tells you how big the army is. So that's Napoleon leaving Paris. So he walks in. He's saying, what are all these little things? He gets distracted along the way, and he invades Poland and, you know, these countries. Oh, that looks like an easy country to invade. Right? But he keeps marching and he gets to the outskirts of Russia and he keeps going. How many of you have been to Russia? It's big. It's getting to Moscow once you're in Russia is not exactly, you know, like walking through Luxembourg. And he keeps marching. He says, this is a really big country. Why this strikes him now, I don't know. You should have thought about this before you invaded the country. So he keeps marching and marching. Notice that the width of this group, what is that telling you? The army is getting smaller. And he's not even fought anybody yet. It's getting colder as he's marching. December 15th, he's on the outskirts of Moscow, victory. Right? But have you ever been, if you haven't been in Moscow in December, my suggestion is don't go. It's really, really cold. And that's what Napoleon said. It's really, really cold. I want to go home. He never even went into Moscow. In fact, if you go to Moscow, there's this big gate where the Russians are very proud about the fact that they stopped Napoleon. They didn't even have to. The weather stopped Napoleon. And he starts to march back. So there's Napoleon marching back. This is now the black line. And as he's marching back, look at, see this? That's the temperature dropping as he's marching back. Look at the army. By the time he gets back to Paris, it's three guys carrying Napoleon into Paris. This is a great graph. It captures everything that happened to Napoleon in one picture. I mean, all you have to show is what happens to your net present value as margins change, right? You have a much less difficult task. But I want you to think creatively when you think about presenting your numbers, because that's how you capture people's attention and that's how you get better decisions made. So that's the second way. Do what if, but be very careful about what you're trying to do with your what if analysis. And there's a third approach, and this is something you could not have done more than 10 years ago. You know what a simulation is? Remember when I gave you the Disney theme park numbers? I gave you numbers. I said, this is what I expect as revenues. I think expenses are going to be 60% of revenues. I think the country risk premium is going to be 3%. Those were estimates, point estimates. But in fact, they came from distributions, right? Whenever you make an estimate, it comes from a distribution. Historically, because we cannot put distributions into our analyses, we give point estimates. So if I ask you, how many games are the Yankees going to win this season? You can give me a number, 135. That's hopeful thinking. Or 92. Even if you're being realistic, the reality is that could be as low as 74, maybe 106. Who knows? There's a distribution around every estimate you make. A simulation actually allows you to be explicit about your uncertainty and bring it into your analysis. So rather than give me a single number, I ask you to give me a distribution. So I said, tell me what you think the revenues will be, but give me a range. In this case, you gave me my base revenues when you did the DCF valuation, but let's say you say, look, they could be 20% lower or 20% higher. This is real. I don't know how many Latin Americans will actually come into the Disney theme park, so I made the revenues a distribution. Then remember I said the expenses are going to be 60% of revenues? That was based on Disneyland and Disney World. You say, I don't know what's going to be in Rio. Maybe it's going to be lower or higher. So here, I've essentially allowed the revenues to be anywhere from, so the 60% is still my base, but it could be as low as 48 and as high as 72. Again, reflecting the fact that you're uncertain. That's called a triangular distribution. Okay? And finally, for the country risk premium, I used a 3% premium, but Brazil could get much riskier or much safer. And I put a distribution around, a normal distribution. So how does this help me? Here's what you do in a simulation. You go pick a number out of the revenue distribution. Will that number be a good number or a bad number? Could be either. It could be higher than you expected or lower. You pick an expense out of the expense distribution. It could be higher than 60 or lower than 60. And you pick a number out of the country risk premium distribution. Then you value the company with those numbers. Then you put them back and you try them again and again. In the default case of the program that I used, it runs 100,000 simulations. In 1 minute. In fact, it's on every PC, every Excel in Stern has it. It's called Crystal Ball, if you've never used it. Okay? It converts any Excel spreadsheet almost magically into a simulation. 100,000 simulations. And each time it runs this, it comes up with a net present value. And this is what the output from the simulation is. Instead of giving you one value, it gives you a distribution of net present values in the project. And the median net present value is 3.28 billion, very close to what I got in my base case. You say, why did we waste our time even doing this? What are we worried about with the project? That it could be a bad project, right? I can tell you the chance it could be a bad project. All I have to do is count the number of NPVs less than zero and say, you know what? It's going to be negative 12% of the time. Do with it whatever you want. Best case is in there, worst case is in there. It's all in the distribution. But to do all of this, what do I have to do? I have to be willing to put distributions around my assumptions. Let me ask you a question. How do I come up with these distributions? In fact, in Crystal Ball, if you go in, there are, it gives you a choice of 53 different distributions that you can pick from. Let me ask you another question. I'd like an honest answer. When did you do statistics? Was it last year? What's the only distribution you remember from your statistics class? Now do you see the problem? And this is 1 year after your statistics class. 10 years after the statistics class, guess what? The only distribution that sticks in your head is normal. So here's what people do with crystal ball. They go in and say 53 distributions. I don't know, Bernoulli, I never heard of this. Log normal, I have no idea what that is. Exponential, that sounds too weird. I'm normal, so I'll pick normal. So after a while, every distribution you pick is normal. So you pick a normal distribution because it's the only distribution you recognize. And of course, if you pick a normal distribution, what's it going to ask you? It's going to ask you for an expected value and a standard deviation. The expected value you have from your base case. The standard deviation, you have no idea. So you make up a number. Who knows? 30%, 50%, 80%. It's garbage in, garbage out. You'll have great-looking garbage at the end. But I don't want to see this on the Netflix case. Why? Because I know exactly what you guys will do to my assumptions. You put in all kinds of distributions because they look neat. But if you really worked for Netflix, you see what you'd have to do? You'd actually have to do research on the number of subscribers. I gave you the base case. This is what will happen if you build a studio. But that's just an expected value. You do the test marketing to see how the high numbers and low numbers. You could actually come up with distributions. I'm saying you cannot do that. But at this point, you don't have the data to do the distributions. But if you do, it gives you an added layer of ways of dealing with uncertainty that they otherwise could not have. So you can do the payback period. That's a very old-fashioned approach. You can ask what-if questions. And if you can, you can do a Monte Carlo simulation. It's an incredibly useful tool to have. So if you get a chance, even if it's not in the context of Netflix, play with that crystal ball. I mean, take something very simple and put in a distribution, see what it does. It'll give you a very interesting perspective on what risk is. Risk is not a bug in the model. It's a feature. And the sooner we can get our hands around it, the better we'll deal with it. So at this stage, I'm going to turn it back to you. So you have a net present value of 3.29 billion. There's a 12% chance or a 10% chance that the net present value could be negative. How do you use this information? I'll give you the choices. You can accept the investment and print off the Monte Carlo simulation, put it into a folder, in which case if somebody asks you, did you do diligence, you can put it on and say, look, I did a simulation. The second is you can say, I'm going to reject this investment because I will take projects only if there's no chance that my net present value could be negative. In which case, you're behaving like a very risk-averse decision maker. Or maybe the point of doing this is not so much to change your decision, but to change the way you manage the project. What do I mean by that? Let's say you take the project, right? What is the simulation telling you? That big changes in revenues could hurt you, right? That big, the expense of 72 versus 48, it could hurt you. Maybe you'll find a way to make that spread smaller. Maybe you can find more information that'll make your revenue estimate more precise. Maybe you can reduce the expense spread by entering into contracts that lock in your costs. This is not just about what happens at the time of the decision. It's how you manage the project thereafter. Okay? So don't be afraid of uncertainty. It's something you're going to face when you do analyses. It's something you're going to have to face when you make decisions. Okay? And you have to be willing to kind of take a deep breath and go through. It will make you uncomfortable. And that's natural, but you still have to make decisions. Any questions on dealing with uncertainty? So now I'm going to switch tacks and talk about a different way you can look at projects. So in the Disney project, I looked at operating income and invested capital, cash flows before debt payments and cost of capital to make a judgment on, was this a good project? Now I'm going to talk about what would be different if I did everything with an equity hat. In other words, if I looked at projects as an equity investor. Okay? As an equity investor, all I care about is me. I look at the earnings I make as an equity investor. I look at the cash flows after debt payments. I look at the rate of return as my cost of equity. But everything we do is going to mirror what I did in the Disney approach, but everything will have an equity twist. So from an accounting perspective, I'm going to compare return on equity to cost of equity, not return on capital to cost of capital. When I do net present value, I'm going to discount cash flows after debt payments at the cost of equity, and I'm going to subtract out the equity investment to come up with the net present value. It's going to look a lot like what I did in the Disney case, but everything's going to have an equity twist. So let me take that second investment I talked about, which is the iron ore mine that Vale is going to be planning to invest in, and use the equity approach to illustrate what's going to be different. So this is going to be a new mine that Vale is considering investing in. I'm going to do everything in U.S. dollars simply because mines are usually denominated, the currency is U.S. dollars because revenues go out in dollars. So it's going to be a $1.25 million initial investment and expected to have a production capacity of 8 million tons. The initial investment is going to get depreciated over 10 years down to a salvage value of $250 million. Already you can see the distinction, right? With the theme park, I kept it going. Here, I'm going to, at the end of 10 years, salvage the iron ore mine and get whatever I can, $250 million. The mine will start production midway through the first year, producing 4 million tons in year one and then expanding to 6 million in year two and 8 million thereafter. The price per ton of iron ore at the time that I set up this problem was $100. I'll come back and talk about that because that price is now down to about $35. But at the time I did this analysis, it was $100. Okay? The variable cost of production is $45 per ton. There's a fixed cost of $125 million. The cost will be in Canadian dollars, but I've converted the, because it's a Canadian mine, but I've converted them all into U.S. dollars at the exchange rate prevailing then, which is a dollar for every Canadian dollar. That too has changed because I was in Canada last week, and it's definitely not dollar for dollar anymore. The working capital requirements will be 20% of revenues, but they have to be made at the beginning of each year, as opposed to the end of each year, which I did for Disney. And finally, the tax rate is 34%. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this mine, looking at it from the perspective of equity investors rather than the entire company. One thing I want to add to this, Vale is going to borrow $500 million at the cost of debt of 4.05%. It's going to borrow in U.S. dollars. And the loan is going to be a term loan. You know what a term loan is? You pay off the loan in equal annual installments. So what will happen is each year your total payment is the same, $61.8 million. But the breakup of that payment each year will change, initially from mostly principal to mostly interest. If you ever take a mortgage loan on a house, is a term loan. The payments are exactly the same, but in the first month it's almost all principal. And in the first month, it's almost all interest. In the last month, it's all principal. So it's just the way of paying off the loan. Why do I care? If the total payment is $61.8 million, I care about cash flows. I'm paying out $61.8 million every year, right? So why do I care how much is interest and how much is principal? And when you say it's about deductions, what exactly does that mean? Interest expense is tax deductible, principal payments are not. So I need to know what portion of your payments are tax deductible. That's why I need the breakdown. So you ready? We're going to do the cash flows on this iron ore mine. And the cash flows you're going to see are going to be after interest expenses because I'm interested in equity investors. To get to those cash flows, I'm going to first start with equity earnings. And because I'm doing everything from an equity perspective, my discount rate now has to be a cost of equity. Do you see the why I'm switching from cost of capital to cost of equity? Because I'm doing everything from an equity perspective, I care about the cost of equity. So earlier on in the class, I estimated the cost of equity and the cost of capital for Vale's different businesses. This is an iron ore mine. So the cost of equity you're going to see in US dollar terms is 11.13%. You're going to start to see that show up as my discount rate because my cash flows are to equity and they're for an iron ore mine. So it's same principle as with the theme park. Go to the business, but this time I'm looking at the cost of equity. So I have everything set up. Let me look at the cash flows. So here's what my first attempt was to get to equity income. Okay, so let's start at the top. There's a number of tons of iron ore that I produced, which was given in the prom, and the price per ton. There's a 2% inflation rate, so the price per ton of iron ore is increasing. There are my revenues. Start at $408 million, end at $975 million. My variable costs are tied to my revenue, so they increase as my revenues go up. My fixed costs grow at inflation, so that's why they don't grow as fast. My depreciation is accelerated, so it's that initial amount being written off, starting high and getting lower over time. I subtract those out, I come up with earnings before interest and taxes, and you can see I'm losing money in year one. But now comes something I did not do with my Disney theme park. I'm subtracting out the interest expenses each year, and you're wondering where those numbers come from? They should be coming from this column right there, 20.25, 18.57, so there's my interest expense. And there's my taxable income each year. I'm losing money in year one, but because I'm a money-making company, I save on taxes that year elsewhere, so that's my negative taxes. So there's my net income. The only difference between what I'm doing here and what I did for Disney is this is after interest expenses. That's why it's net income. Whereas for Disney, I looked at operating income before interest expenses. Now, each year, I also keep track of what my book value of equity is because now, because I'm equity-focused, it's not just what I've invested in the project. It's what portion of it that is equity that I have to factor in. And there's my book value of equity. It starts at $591.5 million, ends at year 10 at $250 million. It decreases because the project is getting smaller and smaller. It's depreciating and becoming smaller. Everything I need. I have the net income. I have the book equity. If I divide the net income by the book value of equity, I have a table that looks just like that Disney table, but in this case, because I'm dividing net income by book equity, instead of getting a return on capital, I'm going to get a return on equity, and the average return on equity over the next 10 years on this iron ore mine is 31.36%, which is, of course, higher than my cost of equity, which makes this, at least from an accounting perspective, into a good project. So I'm almost replicating what I did for Disney. What I'd do if I were you, because there are a lot of numbers in these tables, is take the Disney numbers and these numbers and set them next to each other so you can see the difference between computing cash flows of the firm and cash flow to equity. Because that's really the key to understanding what it means when you say, I'm going to do everything from an equity perspective. So from an accounting perspective, this project looks good. Because I want to get to book value of equity. That's how you get to book value of equity, right? Because the book value of capital includes both debt plus equity. Think of the balance sheet. This is the book value of the liability side of the balance sheet of the project. I have to take out the portion that is debt to get to book value of equity because I need a return on equity. Disney, because I looked at total capital. So that's, in fact, why I wanted to compare the two is you have to make sure, and what you have to avoid is going back and forth. Because if you start with one and go to the other, all kinds of bad things can happen to you. Make your decision as to how you're going to approach the analysis. Stick with that all the way through. Well, the only thing you gain by going the equity route is, if, for instance, you're in real estate, you really don't care about the entire building. You care about your investment in the building. So you say the bank can take care of itself. So this is for very heavily levered transactions. You might look at the equity because it will give you some serious indications of whether you're going to be in trouble in terms of being able to cover your cash flows. Because you have to meet the debt payments, right? So it's more for levered transactions in very in a narrow set of businesses that use equity approaches. Okay? LBO people look at equity approaches because they have to. Because their equity has to, you know, that's they're worried about debt payments. So if I were looking at a company, if I want to look at a company, just as I compared return on capital to Disney to the cost of capital, I could do a return on equity for Disney versus cost of equity. Okay? So I could do this for every company. Okay? The one thing, though, with return on equity is your if you look at how return equity is computed, it's net income divided by book equity. Can book equity be a negative number for a company? Yes, it can. In fact, one out of every 9 U.S. companies has a negative book equity. How do you end up with a negative book equity? And how do you end up with negative retained earnings? In other words, if you start with the company, the way you do book accounting is you start with what you, with the book value of equity that reflects your starting as a company. Each time you lose money, you reduce that book equity. But you keep losing money and losing money and losing money. At some point in time, your equity is zero and keeps going. Now, is that a dangerous thing? Not necessarily. Young startups, it's not at all uncommon to see negative book equity. LinkedIn had negative book equity for a while. Facebook had negative book equity early in its life. So by itself, it's neither here nor there. But here's why I brought it up. What's return equity? It's net income divided by book value of equity, right? So if you have a money-losing company that has a negative book equity, and you've turned your brain off, you're dividing one by the other, you divide a negative by a negative, what do you end up with? A positive. And then you tell me, my company has an incredible return equity of 38%. And I look at your numbers, and you've divided minus 100 by minus 330, and you say you have a good company. I'd be very cautious about what I'm drawing a conclusion on. So watch out for negative book equities, because many of you in this class, when you get back to your project, remember that? I didn't nag you today. Have you picked a company? Have you done this stuff? At some point in time, you'll have to do all of that stuff, and it's going to be sooner rather than later. Some of you will have a negative book equity. So just be ready when it happens. So now let's move from accounting returns to cash flows. Well, to get from net income to free to cash flow to equity, here are the adjustments I need to make. I need to add back depreciation that I did before. I need to subtract out CapEx. We did that before. Subtract out change in working capital. We did that before. So if this had been cash flow to the firm, I'd be done, right? You see the additional line item that I've added, which is debt repayments. I did not have to do that with Disney because, again, I was doing cash flow to the firm. But because this is cash flow to equity, I need to subtract out cash flows associated with debt. That's what this principal repayment is. And finally, because I'm shutting the mine down at the end of the 10th year, I get the $250 million back. So instead of a terminal value, this is it, the mine ends. You're saying, why don't you keep the mine going and going? It's an iron ore mine. There's no iron left in there. What the heck are you going to keep digging and digging for? So unlike a traditional project where you can say this project can keep going, here I've stopped at the end of year 10. One more loose end. Notice all these working capital investments I've made for the next. So I start in year zero. Why? Because I make my investments at the start of each year, and I make it every year. At the end of the 10th year, what am I doing? What's working capital? It's inventory you're building up, right? Receivables you gave. So each year when you put an inventory, I'm saying, oh, that's a drain on your cash flows. That's a drain. You get to the end of year 10, you're shutting the mine down. What are you going to do with all your inventory? I hope not throw it off in the street. You're going to try to liquidate it and get the cash flows back. That's just all your working capital over the first 10 years taken back. So if you terminate a project, make sure you don't leave your working capital hanging out there. It's got to come back. You have to make some assumption about it. Tell me what happens at the end of year 10 to your working capital here because your project ends. So that's the big difference between what I... Why didn't I liquidate working capital in the Disney theme park? Because after year 10, what do? I keep the project going. If your project continues, you can't liquidate the working capital. It has to continue with the project. So that's, again, a difference between an infinite life project and a finite life project. So that's another area where Disney and this particular investment are going to look very different. So compare the two because it's going to give you some indication as to how we approach these investments. Finally, why is there no capital maintenance here? It's not just in the mind, but at the end of 10 years, what do I plan to do? Shut it down. It's gone. So I don't need the mind to look good at the end of year 10. What's a good-looking shut-down mind going to look like relative to a bad-looking shut-down mind? So basically, there's no capital maintenance because right from the start, I'm saying, I don't plan to run this mine for more than 10 years, so everything gets shut down. So that's it. There's my cash flow to equity. I discount those cash flows to equity back at my cost of equity for iron ore mines in U.S. dollars because I did everything in U.S. dollars. My net present value for this mine is $304 million. So help me again. If you're the decision maker, I show you this net present value. What does it say? Take the mine. It's a good project. In fact, if I did an internal rate of return, I'll confirm it even more. The internal rate of return for this project is almost 26%. Great project. You're feeling really good about this, right? You've taken the project. You sit back, waiting for the cash to roll in. All of this is conditioned on, though, what? What did I assume about the iron ore price? $100 per ounce, per ton. Based on that price, this looks like a really good investment. So here's what I'm going to do to close the process. In computing the net present value, first, let's get this out of the way. I used U.S. dollar cash flows and a U.S. dollar cost of equity. I could have done everything in real terms. What's real? I could have taken inflation out of the cash flows and inflation out of the discount rate. Would my net present value have been different if I'd done that? What will happen first to my cash flows? If I take the inflation out, the cash flows will be lower, right? You're saying that's bad. But if I take my discount rate and I take the inflation out, the discount rate is going to be lower. Whatever I lose by having lower cash flows, I'll exactly gain back by having a lower discount rate. Same reason, currency doesn't matter. Whether you go nominal or real doesn't matter because, again, you're taking it out of both halves of your analysis. It should not affect your numbers. So here's what I want to do now. I want to scare you a little bit. Project looked great, right? Net present value is positive, but everything is conditioned on what that iron ore price is. So I said, hey, what if iron ore prices change? And in particular, as iron ore prices decrease, here's my net present value. It's positive until you get to about $89 per ounce, and then it collapses. So if commodity prices change, obviously the project goes from being a good project to a bad project. That's the first thing to worry about. The second is, I am also assuming parity between the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar. Remember the one-to-one that I assumed? What if the Canadian dollar becomes weaker or stronger? If it gets weaker, Vale's actually benefited. How come? Why would having an, if you're having your iron ore mine in Canada, why would a weaker Canadian dollar help you? Well, it's not that you can export more, but your costs, in a sense, decrease in U.S. dollar terms. That's why, in fact, if you look at all these central banks trying to weaken their own currencies, why would they do that? It makes your exporters have an advantage because it means their costs have been decreased in a foreign currency terms. Okay? So if the Canadian dollar gets weaker, the net present value goes up. If the Canadian dollar gets stronger, in fact, if it gets more than 18% stronger, your net present value turns negative. You see what I'm trying to tell you? You could make this decision with the best information and conclude it's a good decision. But there are two big macro variables swirling around you. One is what happens to iron ore prices. The other is what happens to exchange rates. Can you protect yourself against those big risks? In fact, that's going to be my next question. You're Vale. The project looks good, but you're worried about these big macro risks. Should you go out there and hedge against, so let's start with iron ore prices. Should Vale go out? You know what I mean by hedge? What does hedging here involve in? You could go in and lock in the prices at which you can sell the iron ore for the next 10 years. There are futures prices. Should Vale hedge itself against iron ore prices? I can see a lot of people say, of course they should have. It's gone down to 35. That's not fair. You can't use the benefit of hindsight to say they should have hedged. Of course, in hindsight, everything's going to be. This is actually a very general question. Should commodity companies go out and hedge against commodity prices? How many of you have shares in oil companies? I do. Nobody else? I'm the only one? I just bought some shares. I bought some shares in ExxonMobil. I bought some shares in Lukoil. Why do I buy shares in Lukoil? Because I love the way the companies run. I have no idea. This is a Russian company. How the hell do I know how it's run? It's like a mystery wrapped in an enigma, like Winston Churchill said, nobody. You know why I invest in Lukoil? Because I think oil prices will eventually bounce back up. They're at $40, I think. You see where I'm going? I invest in an oil company not because I love the man. This is not Apple, where I say, I like the new iPad Pro that's coming out. Oil is oil. The only reason you invest in oil companies is because you want to make a play on oil prices. You see where I'm going to go next? Let's say this oil company goes out and now hedges future oil prices. Let's say I'm right and oil prices go to $75 a barrel. I'm feeling good, right? And then I look at this company's earnings. What am I going to see? I'm not going to see any upward movement because what did they do? They went in and locked themselves up at a $40 oil price. I think it's a really bad idea for commodity companies to go in and hedge against commodity prices because by doing so, they're taking away the reason I invest in them. You know that if there are studies that have looked, this is actually a very big issue with commodity companies. Some companies hedge their production and some companies don't. And historically, commodity companies that hedge their production trade at lower prices than companies that don't because investors just don't like it, with one exception. You know what the exception is? If you have a lot of debt as a commodity company, it might make sense for you to at least hedge some of your production. Why? What do you have to do to benefit from the higher oil prices that will eventually be here? You've got to make it. You've got to survive. So if you're an oil company with a lot of debt and you don't make it, then it doesn't matter if oil prices go to 75. That's the only exception where I think hedging makes sense is if you have a lot of debt and you're worried about distress risk. Yeah. You can, but were options free? It's a fair price, so you get some upside. There are no free lunches here. Whatever you use to hedge, you will still give up a chunk of your upside when you hedge. And as a commodity company, if that's the way you're surviving, then it really does. So it doesn't make sense to hedge your output variable if that's what you do, because investors are investing in you because they want to play on the output variable. Okay. So let me stop there. When we pick up on Wednesday, we'll talk about exchange rates and whether you should hedge those, because those are the most hedged macro variables in practice.
Exactly the inflation factor.
The discovery would be lower?
Yeah, without inflation in it, right? You have to take inflation out of it.
Wouldn't your discount rate be higher?
How can it be higher? You're using a US dollar discount rate which has a 2% inflation in it, so if you take inflation out, how can your real discount rate be lower, higher than your nominal discount rate?
Well, because like you mentioned here, you use this as like the inflation rate.
What's that got to do with discount rates? Yeah.
Isn't this your terminal value?
Yeah, what are you asking here? So that's a different project altogether. Are we talking about the Vale iron ore project, or are you talking about something else?
Well, I mean, like, just in general, like.
So if you had done the Disney project in real terms,
yeah.
What will the growth be after year 10?
Zero.
Your discount rate, which is 8.46%, which is a dollar cost of capital, would have to be?
The same.
No, it's a nominal U.S. dollar cost of capital. What's the inflation rate in U.S. dollars? It's 2%. There's a 2% inflation rate in the 8.46%, so you'd have to take out the 2% from the 8.46%.
Oh, because that includes a 2%.
Yeah. Anytime you use a currency, nominal cost of capital, it includes the inflation in that currency.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, how are you?
So I was not able to pick up my test 2 weeks ago or so. Where can I find it now?
You can come up with me right now.
Okay, awesome. I guess I'll let you.
So I was in a group of five, and then three of them came to you, I think, a week before spring break, and they're like, could we work in a group of three, and that leaves me and the other person. So I was wondering if I could just work in a group of two with them, because it's kind
for
of
the case.
For the case, and like the ultimate group project.
I don't remember anybody saying, can I work in a group of three?
It was Ahan's group, if you remember. Ahan, Chase, and Shakira, they wanted to work in a group of three. So I was wondering if I could just work in a pair. I mean, it's not like less work or anything, right?
No, it's the same. It's actually a little more work.
Yeah, so I prefer that, actually.
Okay.
That work?
It's fine.
Thank
you. What about them?
Okay, so I have a little complaint. I'm actually